How many of you know something about the case of Sacco and Vanzetti? How many of you, I know this is an embarrassing question, how many of you really don't know about the case of Sacco and Vanzetti? Okay. And then there are some of you who neither know nor not know about the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. When I was growing up and becoming I suppose what is now called a political person, that is getting interested in politics and social issues, you know, one of the things that sprang out at me as one of the most dramatic events in American history was the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. And it plays a part in American history that so many other events have played, you know, very, very special moments in history that affect an entire generation. I mean, this is true, you know, I know there's a list of these things there's a traditional list of these things which go as important historical events, like the Battle of Bunker Hill and things like that. But there's another kind of list, an alternate list, of events which did a lot to awaken people's political consciousness. The Haymarket Affair of 1886 was one of them. If you don't know much about the Haymarket Affair, look into it. But somebody like Emma Goldman, as a teenager in a working class family working in a factory in Rochester, when the Haymarket Affair took place, the arrest and conviction and execution of a group of anarchists in Chicago in 1886 during a battle for the 8-hour day. When Emma Goldman heard about that, it really changed her life. And so with the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, as with, I think, other people with the Rosenberg case. And who knows what effect the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal is having now and will have on generations of people to come. When we had 20 years ago the 50th anniversary of the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, the governor of Massachusetts, Governor Dukakis, set up a commission. There's been a lot of discussion over the state of Massachusetts apologizing, doing something for executing these two men. You know, governments do that from time to time. They apologize. Khrushchev apologized for the people in the Soviet Union who apologized. Well, sorry, we killed a few people. Clinton has apologized for slavery. I don't want to make light of these apologies. Well, yes, I do. I have to hand it to Dukakis. Dukakis set up a commission to go back into the Sacco and Vanzetti case, and they came out with a report, and the report declared that. There were people who said, Dukakis should pardon Sacco and Vanzetti. Apparently, he thought it was a little late. They had been executed in 1927, and this is 1977. But his commission did come out with a report which said that Sacco and Vanzetti had not had a fair trial. This was an understatement of some sort. But when this happened, this aroused a kind of reaction among people who defended the execution of Sacco and Vanzetti, and people who defended the record of the authorities of Massachusetts, and I mean, after all, the authorities were involved in this—the lower courts, the upper courts, the governor, Governor Fuller of Massachusetts—and there was at the time of the son of Governor Fuller was alive and living in Boston. He was more than alive. He actually ran a Cadillac dealership in Boston. And he wrote a letter to the Boston Globe, and he was known for several things, not just for being Boston's leading Cadillac dealer, but as a racer of thoroughbred horses. And I can see races between the horses and the Cadillacs. And Peter Fuller, he was also, come to think of it, he was a member of the Board of Trustees of Boston University. And he was outraged at Dukakis's statement saying that Sacco and Vanzetti had not had a fair trial. He said, this is, quote, an attempt to besmirch a guy's record that we believe in and love, whose memory we cherish. We're sitting here. I always like the word besmirch. How can you not feel sympathy for somebody who has been besmirched? And then he said, we're sitting here in the last building my father built. And it's the most beautiful car agency on the Eastern Coast and perhaps in the United States. I didn't quite see what this had to do with the Sacco and Vanzetti case, you see, but anyway, the issue is alive because the issue of justice is always alive, the issue of law and not just of capital punishment, but you know, of the entire judicial system. And just for a brief kind of summary of the events, and it starts in the spring of 1920. That is not long after the end of World War I. There's a robbery and murder. This is very much a Massachusetts affair. There's a robbery at a shoe factory in South Braintree, Massachusetts, not far from here, and the paymaster is killed, and a guard is killed. Two people are killed, and the robber. Well, shortly after that, no, it's not clear who did it. There are eyewitnesses or people who claim there are eyewitnesses, but in any case, shortly after that, Sacco and Vanzetti, and Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti are picked up. They're there on a streetcar going from Bridgewater to Brockton. They're carrying guns, revolvers, and they're picked up and they're arrested for the robbery and the murder. And that's the beginning of the case of Sacco and Vanzetti. What follows then is years of trials and appeals. And I suppose say something about the circumstances of that time of 1920. There's why Sacco and Vanzetti. Was it because the evidence pointed to them? It's hard to say. The evidence in this case is so muddied and so complicated that to this day people argue about whether Sacco and Vanzetti were guilty of this. And there are people who say they absolutely were not, and people who say they absolutely were, and then there are people who say Sacco was guilty, but Vanzetti was not. A liberal compromise, I guess. But in any case, what happens in this period, Sacco and Vanzetti are anarchists. They're not just ordinary people found in the streetcar carrying guns. They've been on lists. They've been known to the police. They've been known to the Bureau of Investigation as a predecessor of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They have no criminal record, but they have a political record. They've been supporters of strikes, and they've walked on picket lines, and they handed out leaflets, and they're part of the anarchist movement on the East Coast. And there is a kind of special Italian anarchist movement, you know, on the East Coast. And, you know, they're friends with somebody named Luigi Galliani, who is the editor of an anarchist publication called the Cronica Sovversiva. You can figure out what that means. What's happening now after World War I is there is a kind of wave of anti-radical and anti-foreign hysteria in the country. Starts during the war. I mean, during the war, we have the build-up of hostility to radicals, to people who oppose the war. And Congress passes the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, and the Supreme Court affirms the constitutionality of these acts, which punish people for speaking, really, punish people for speaking out against the war. And 900 or so people are, about 2,000 people are prosecuted, and about 900 people are sent to prison for a violation of the Espionage Act or the Sedition Act, and basically for making speeches against the war. Eugene Debs, the socialist leader, is sentenced to 10 years in prison for making a speech against the war. A woman, is sentenced to several years, a woman in the Midwest sentenced to several years in jail for making a remark, which is overheard by somebody else, that the socks that people are supposedly knitting for the soldiers overseas are not really getting to those soldiers. A movie is confiscated and banned, and the maker of the movie is put on trial for violating the Espionage Act, because the movie is about the Revolutionary War. And in the Revolutionary War, you may remember, the enemy is England. In World War I, England is our ally. So somebody makes a movie in which England is the enemy, when England is really our ally, obviously doesn't know who are our friends and who are our enemies, and a person like that should be prosecuted. And the name of this movie, incidentally, was The Spirit of 76, and so the name of the case was U.S. versus Spirit of 76. But this is the kind of thing that went on. It was when the war was over, there was a bomb explosion. And by the way, anarchists, I don't want to paint the anarchists of this time as peace-loving, Martin Luther King-type, non-violent people. There were anarchists who believed in using violence against the class enemy. There were other anarchists who didn't. The fact that there were anarchists who believed in this didn't therefore mean that if an act of violence took place, therefore it must be that anarchists are responsible. I mean, that's what had happened in the Haymarket affair, where nobody knew who was responsible for the bomb that exploded amidst the police in 1886. But since there were anarchists around in Chicago, and some of them had written statements advocating violence, it's figured that they must have been responsible, you know, and therefore deserve to be executed. A bomb had exploded in front of the home of Attorney General Palmer, Woodrow Wilson's Attorney General, and this led to a great excitement and search for radicals and bomb throwers and anarchists. And the search took the form mainly of breaking into the homes and meeting places of foreign-born people, on the supposition that that's where you are most likely to find bomb throwers and troublemakers. And thousands of these people were rounded up and held without, bail, held without hearings, held incommunicado, and many, many of them deported. Two of the people deported in the course of this thing were Emma Goldman, the feminist anarchist leader, and her friend Alexander Berkman, But this is what was going on, and the editor of Cronica Sovietica, Luigi Galliani, he was deported, and another anarchist was picked up, a man named Salcedo, and he picked up and kept by the FBI, by the Bureau of Investigation, in an office up on the 14th floor of a building in downtown Manhattan. He was kept there for 6 weeks, not allowed to see a lawyer, not allowed to talk to anybody, and he was interrogated for 6 weeks. At the end of the 6 weeks, his body was found on this pavement below that 14th floor office. And the Bureau of Investigation said that he jumped. And no one knows. Did he jump? Maybe. Was he pushed? Who knows? Did he jump because he was being driven crazy by the Bureau of Investigation? Did he jump because he felt guilty, being an anarchist? Who knows? But in any case, all of these, I tell you about these events because all of these events are having an impact on the thinking of the anarchist community and the foreign-born anarchists like Sacco and Vanzetti. And it explains, and this is how they explained it, and it seems reasonable, that that's why they were carrying guns. All of them, or anybody in that community who's expecting to be raided or to be apprehended, to be seized by the police, to be interrogated, to be deported, and so on, they were carrying guns. Was that the explanation for them carrying guns? I don't know. I don't know, I'll tell you right now, I don't know if Sacco and Vanzetti were guilty of this robbery and murder. And the truth is, that's not the issue that interests me the most. Because whether they were guilty or were innocent, there are larger questions involved, and the questions have to do with justice, the nature of justice, and the way justice is meted out in our society, and that the fact that that justice really doesn't have a lot to do with whether people are innocent or guilty of a particular crime, and has a lot more to do with who people are, what they represent, what they do in their lives, and what threats they pose, not to this individual or that individual, but what threats they pose to the existing societal structure. And it was assumed that the anarchists posed a threat to the existing social structure in the United States. And when they were picked up, police interrogation, the record of the police interrogation, does not suggest that the police were most concerned about whether they had committed the robbery and murder. But here are the questions from the police interrogation. Police to Sacco: are you a citizen? Sacco: no. Police: are you a communist? Sacco: no. Anarchist? Sacco: no, he's lying. Now, why somebody should lie to the police is beyond me. But he chose to lie to the police. But the point is that what were they interested in? They were interested in whether he was a communist or an anarchist, and what bearing does this have on whether he was guilty of this robbery and murder? The whole case was suffused by patriotism and appeals to the flag, and that was the atmosphere, you know, in which it took place. At the very beginning of the trial, the judge, Judge Webster Thayer, said to the jury, "Gentlemen," no ladies on the jury, "gentlemen, I call upon you to render this service here that you have been summoned to perform with the same spirit of patriotism, courage, and devotion to duty as was exhibited by our soldier boys across the seas." Strange kind of charge to the jury, putting them in the same position as soldiers doing their patriotic duty, especially in light of the fact that Sacco and Vanzetti had left this country, had gone to Mexico to avoid the draft. They were draft dodgers. They had not fulfilled their patriotic duty. Now the jury was going to fulfill its patriotic duty. More of the police interrogation. Police to Sacco, do you believe in this government of ours? Yes, some things I like different. That's a very diplomatic answer. He really likes things very different, but he's being shrewd. Do you subscribe for literature of the Anarchist Party? Sometimes I read them. How do you get them? Through the mail? A man gave one to me in Boston. Who was the man? I don't know him. Again, were they looking for robbers? Are they looking for people who subscribe to anarchist magazines, and et cetera, you know, et cetera? The trial, incidentally, began immediately after Memorial Day. This was about a year and a half after that sort of orgy of death and stupidity that was World War I. The military music was still in the air when the trial took place. And in fact, 12 days into the trial, the press reported that the bodies of three soldiers were returning from France, three American soldiers from France to Brockton, and the whole town was turning out for a patriotic ceremony. All of this the jury could read in the newspapers, because they could read the newspapers. The only thing they couldn't read were the reports on the trial that were cut out. And in the midst of the trial, the papers reported a gathering of 5,000 veterans of the Yankee Division in Plymouth. In the trial itself, in the cross-examination of Sacco, and here's Prosecutor Katzman. Katzman to Sacco, did you love this country in the last week of May 1917? I guess we could go through day by day and see on what days you loved the country, on what days you didn't love the country. Sacco, that is pretty hard for me to say in one word, Mr. Katzman. By the way, Sacco's English was much better than Vanzetti's. Vanzetti had a much harder time with the English language, although, well, that's, you'll see that after he spent a number of years in prison and after he reads, his eloquence in the English language is absolutely extraordinary. So he says, that is pretty hard for me to say in one word, Mr. Katzman. There are two words you can use, Mr. Sacco. Yes or no? Which is it? Sacco, yes. He did love this country in the last week of May, 1917. Well, again, not really. No, he doesn't really. But Katzman, and in order to show your love for this United States of America, when she was about to call upon you to become a soldier, you ran away to Mexico. Yeah. This is the atmosphere of the trial. It's a very Anglo-Saxon jury. It's a very Anglo-Saxon judge. The two defendants are Italian anarchists, recently come to this country speaking with Italian accents. And as the ethnic divisions in this trial are very, very, very clear. By the way, Webster Thayer, the judge, has specifically asked the Chief Justice to handle this trial. He wanted this trial. You get strange things happen in the course of the trial. There are many witnesses who place Sacco and Manzetti in places other than the scene of the crime. There are a whole bunch of witnesses who say that they saw at one point or another, at just about that time, they saw Sacco in Boston. And Sacco says that he was in Boston at that time trying to get a passport. He was in the office of the Italian consul. So there are all these people testifying that they saw Sacco in Boston. But all these people have Italian accents. Mm-hmm. There are a whole bunch of people testify that they saw Vanzetti at the time that the crime was supposed to have taken place. They saw Vanzetti in Plymouth selling fish. Sacco was a shoemaker. Vanzetti was a fish peddler. All these people. But these people, their words go right past the jury. They're Italians. They're going to stick together. There's a kid who the eyewitness testimony is very peculiar. The eyewitness testimony is very difficult to establish, you know, with absolute clarity. You know, eyewitness testimony is always fraught with mistakes and misapprehensions, and but still, they use it. So they call this kid who says he saw the robbers running away. What could you? They ask him. Well, could you see their faces? No. Well, Bob, what could you tell about these robbers? I could tell that they were foreigners. How could you tell? By the way they ran. Have you ever seen a foreigner run? They are very funny runners. Yeah. And the judge, a famous statement that the judge made, which anybody who studied, who read anything about the case will hear about this, that the judge, somewhere in the course of all of this going on, says at a Dartmouth football game, I guess there's something about a Dartmouth football game which lets the guard down. And you think, I can say anything I want to at a football game. But no, he couldn't, because he said to another sort of Dartmouth alumnus who was at the football game, after he had turned down a motion for a new trial, he said, "Did you see what I did with those anarchist bastards the other day?" The fellow he said this to swore out an affidavit to this effect. So you have to be very careful what you say to people at a football game. And but this is Thayer. This is Webster Thayer. And there's ballistics evidence, very complicated ballistics evidence. I won't go into it, because I can't go into it. That the ballistics argument has been going on for decades, and nobody has come up with any absolutely clear-cut, conclusion about what the ballistic evidence shows. But my point is whether, one thing is sure, whether they're guilty or not, they could not possibly get a fair trial in the atmosphere of the courtroom in 1920, 1921. They could not possibly get a fair trial in the patriotic atmosphere of this courtroom and with this judge and with this jury. And that if Sacco and Vanzetti were convicted, I would argue they're convicted more for who they were than for anything they might possibly have done. And this is the importance of it, because it connects with so many other instances of how our justice system works, and something that with just some reflection and some study we know to be true, and that is, it is very, very important in our justice system. Yes, even more important than whether you really did something or did not something, it is very important who you are. It is very important how much money you have. It is very important what color you are. It is very important whether you, are an American, and it is very important if you are a political radical. Sacco and Vanzetti had all these things against them, just as Mumia Abu-Jamal has all these things. And he's black, he's radical, he's poor. Is he going to get a fair trial? It's not even a matter of knowing for sure guilt or innocence. One thing you do know for sure, so long as those factors are dominant, and those factors are dominant in a society which is filled with jingoism and hostility to foreigners and hostility to blacks and hostility to radicals, and so long as the justice system is dominated by money, then the question of whether you actually did this or did not do this becomes secondary to these other factors. Webster Thayer is asked 6-7 times for a new trial, and different pieces of evidence are put before him. There's a prisoner who sends a message from prison that he was part of a gang that committed the robbery and murder in South Braintree. Well, who knows? Is this true? It's, you know, it might be enough to at least look into it. But Webster Thayer, the judge, does not want to look into it. And so he turns down these things again and again. And the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts goes along with Thayer on all of this, because they never examined the facts of the case. And, you know, this is a very common thing with courts of appeals and so on. Sorry, we can't examine the facts of the case. You know, we only have to rule on these matters of law, and on these matters of law, you don't have a right to a new trial. So you have these exasperating decisions that come down from courts in which somebody's life is at stake. And they say, well, sorry, we know somebody's life is at stake, but we really can't look over the evidence. That's not our job. The Supreme Court, they try to get the Supreme Court of the United States to stay the execution. They try to get Oliver Wendell Holmes. You know, all it takes is one justice of the Supreme Court to stay an execution. This was done for a while in the Rosenberg case. Holmes would not stay the execution. I mean, Holmes is, in any case, one of the most overrated judges in, you know, Supreme Court history, as far as, you know, liberalism and civil liberties and all of that. And it was Holmes who wrote the unanimous decision that sent Eugene Debs to jail. It was Holmes who wrote the, you know, unanimous decision affirming the constitutionality of the Espionage Act. I don't want to get started on Holmes. But the point is, as they say, they had their day in court. This is what people say. They say, what are you complaining about? They had their day in court. All the procedures were followed. They had a trial, they had appeals, they went to the, you know, it went from one court to another, they went to the governor. The governor appointed a committee of three distinguished people. Well, people the governor considered distinguished, who would report to him. You know, this is what executives do from time to time, take the onus off themselves. Let's set up a committee of three important citizens and let them advise me, and then, you know, I don't have to take the whole blame. And so, I mean, how more distinguished a committee can you set up? You pick the president of Harvard University, the president of MIT, and a retired judge. You might say a cross-section of the community. They go over all the stuff, and they come to the conclusion that Sacco and Vanzetti, you know, do not deserve a new trial. And Haywood Bruin, I don't know if any of you know the name Haywood Bruin. Haywood Bruin was a great journalist of that era, of the 1920s and 1930s, and wrote a column actually for, you know, mainstream newspapers, column called It Seems to Me. And he was one of the organizers of the, he was an unusual journalist, one because he was a socialist, and two, because he was one of the organizers of the American Newspaper Guild, which started around that time. And when people said, well, look, we have three of the most distinguished people in Massachusetts to go over the evidence, and they said these guys are guilty, and Haywood Bruin wrote, yes, it is not every prisoner who has a president of Harvard University throw on the switch for him. If this is a lynching, at least the fish peddler and his friend the factory hand may take unction to their souls that they will die at the hands of men in dinner jackets or academic gowns. There were protests all over the country and all over the world. There were demonstrations in Buenos Aires and Paris and in London, all over the United States. And the lawyers kept trying to come up with new theories and new ideas and new bits of evidence. And Sacco said, forget it. It doesn't matter. They want us to die. It doesn't matter what the evidence is. It doesn't matter what legal... There are always people who think this, you know. If I can only come up with the right kind of legal argument, you know, that the legal system will take cognizance of this. And Sacco was saying, no, you're wrong. Given who we are, and given what the legal system is, it doesn't matter what argument you make in a legal brief, they're going to put us to death. The only thing that will matter, and Vanzetti said this at another point, the only thing that will matter is if hundreds of thousands and millions of people take to the streets and create a clamor in the country. That's the only thing that might possibly stop them from killing us. Well, there were protests, but they weren't great enough and didn't match Vanzetti's standards for an enormous protest. And so, that August 23rd, 1927, Charlestown Prison, where the electric chair was, crowds gathered outside, protesters, pickets. There were machine guns mounted on nearby buildings to control the protesters. And people were beaten and people were arrested. Some distinguished literary figures participated in the demonstration, Edna St. Vincent Millay and John Dos Passos. Albert Einstein had protested against this. You know, important figures in the arts had protested against this. And the labor movement, particularly the Italian labor movement, but the labor movement had supported Sacco and Vanzetti and organized protests. But yes, they were executed. And Vanzetti had in his pocket, when he was on that streetcar in Brockton, the day he was arrested, and what he had in his pocket was a leaflet advertising a meeting where he was going to speak. And the leaflet said, "You have fought all the wars. You have worked for all the capitalists. You have wandered over all the countries. Have you harvested the fruits of your labors, the price of your victories? Does the past comfort you? Does the present smile on you? Does the future promise you anything? Have you found a piece of land where you can live like a human being and die like a human being? On these questions, on this argument, and on this theme, the struggle for existence, Bartolomeo Vanzetti will speak." Well, of course, he never got to give that speech, but I thought, well, that says it. You don't want to let somebody make a speech like that. If that speech were made often enough by enough people, to enough people, in a country where for so many of the people in the country that message resonates, you might have some resounding movement for social change in the country. So that was behind the case of Sacco and Vanzetti, and that is behind the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, and that's behind so much of what goes on in our society and so much of what is called the justice system. And so I think it's important, especially in a law school where it is so easily to become sort of, I almost said besmirched, so easy to become befogged, with the niceties of law, to remember that behind the law and above the law, behind the law, you know, there are very, very powerful issues of class and race and gender and social conflict. And if we want justice, we are going to have to engage in some way, engage ourselves in some way in that conflict. Thank you.